Good morning, distinguished judges of the Court of Appeals. I am Lee Wolfgram, and I am appearing on behalf of the appellant in this case. Your Honors, I'm here not to try to minimize the reprehensible conduct of the appellant in this case, and I think under any measure, any of this behavior that the appellant has pled to, has admitted to, is highly reprehensible, and I don't mean this argument or this appeal to in any way diminish the reprehensibility of the conduct.
Well, before you get into the main argument as far as the basis you're asserting for a different sentencing, I want to make sure I understand. As I understand it, your client, he tendered his guilty plea, but it was to both counts one and count two, correct?
That is correct, Your
and
Honor.
And these were both separate behavioral incidences?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and with regard to that, you're only appealing one of the convictions?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and with that said, just so I understand where we're going, you can proceed with your argument.
Well, Your Honor, I guess maybe I should restate that. What I am appealing is the conviction in that the way that the statute applies in this case to both, in that the, I guess, the proportionality argument, I think, applies to both counts.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Wolfgram. Did you represent the appellant at trial also?
I did, Your Honor.
So did you raise either the equal protection or the cruelty of the sentence argument before the district court?
I did not raise them by a...
Some reason why something that's happened between then and now that would have changed the circumstances so as to make it the rare case where we should find that you haven't waived those issues?
Your Honor, I would answer that question to say this. It is in one that I would describe as one of first occurrence to counsel. There isn't...
I don't follow that at all. What do you mean?
It means that it only occurred to me because there's not any case law specifically on point on this. There isn't some...
So you're saying it only occurred to you as you were perfecting your appeal?
It occurred to me after the fact. I was left with this lingering feeling that there should be some graduation in the way that the statute applies.
How can we address something that the district court hasn't even heard or considered? We're an error-correcting court or reviewing court.
Your Honor, in the interest of justice, I agree that this court normally wouldn't hear this, but that in the interest of justice, this is a discretionary call by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals could hear this if it finds that in the interest of justice there is merit to these arguments. So that would be the answer to the question, Your Honor, that I do believe that this court does have the ability in the interest of justice. For one of the reasons is that this would affect numerous other cases of...
Okay, so let's back up. So your argument isn't so much, I mean, your client was given the opportunity to withdraw his plea when his criminal history score turned out to be something other than what it was originally thought. So you're not arguing that he didn't have the opportunity to withdraw his plea. What you're saying is that sitting here now, you're thinking there's reasons that the sentencing guidelines wouldn't fit into, would not be proportional to what occurred?
Your Honor, essentially what I'm standing before the court saying is that, yes, he did have the opportunity under the law, under case law, under guidance that the defense would be able to review at the time. There wouldn't necessarily have been something to bring it, I guess, to the forefront of the mind of this approach. This approach is after reflection and considering the fact that it seems like it's an unfair sentence when compared to other crimes that fall within the same definition of penetration.
What is the authority that you're raising for such a proposition?
And I would grant the court that there isn't authority, and that's what...
You don't cite any authority in your brief and can't recite anything to the court today. We normally wouldn't consider that issue.
I agree, and there's always a point of first impression to the court. There's always a point of first occurrence to counsel, and I understand that.
It's quite a leap. I think this would be something that a legislator in his or her right mind would have to be presented with to try to find some gradation, if you will, in terms of what occurred and what's more harmful to a victim. I mean, you're talking very subjective determinations, and isn't that left to our neighbors across the street, the legislators, not this court?
Well, I believe that the legislature across the street would be able to correct anything that this court identifies as an issue that is raised in the judicial process.
How are we, under your theory, and I don't even know if we even get to your theory, but how are we as sitting jurists in a position where we can sit here and say whether something was more harmful to this victim or not in terms of her long-term scarring and the horrible aftermath of the effects that she experienced?
I would describe it as this, Your Honor. I would say, as there is the concept of judicial notice, I believe there's a concept of human notice, and I don't believe that every penetration has the same effect.
So where do you come up with that proposition? Because I can't imagine there's any support for that. Is this just your view, Mr. Wolfgram, or where is there support that digital penetration should somehow be treated differently than full penile penetration? I just, quite frankly, I don't know what we would even hang our hat on if we wanted to even consider that.
And quite frankly, I'm shocked in your brief that you would say that the risk of disease is lessened because it's not full penile penetration. So what if it was a hairbrush? What if it was a garden hose? What if it was a broomstick? I mean, you're trying to parse this out that anytime there's sexual contact, that we should look at that and decide how this victim was harmed? And then what about the victim? Maybe a victim has more wherewithal to sustain an injury.
That's true, and maybe the victim is subject to much greater harm if there's actual penetration as opposed to just a slightly manipulation of the vaginal fold.
I interrupted Jim Flory's initial question, but I feel very impassioned about this because I don't. What do you suggest we use as a tool to weigh the harm, if you will?
The recognition that all penetration is not the same in its effect.
And is there a scientific study of that?
There is no scientific study that I'm aware of, and that's why I say the concept of human notice. I think that given the court's example of a hairbrush or some other instrument that's used, definitely I would agree that those fall more within the conduct that the rape statute considers, whereas the slight intrusion of the folds, for example, there's what I'm trying to get the court to recognize is that there should be some restraint here from a person going from a slight touch or a slight intrusion into the fold to full penetration. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes. The argument you're making would be appropriately made to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, which is tasked with considering the policy arguments that determine where different crimes should be ranked, which impacts the sentence that is imposed. So the sorts of policy arguments you're making could be made. I think you're making them in the wrong place because we don't establish the grids here or the presumptive sentences. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission does. If you want to succeed in this court, have to provide us with some legal basis to strike down the sentence under the guidelines as they do exist. Now, I see in your brief you're claiming an equal protection constitutional challenge. Could you explain to us why, in your view, there is a valid equal protection challenge here?
Yes, Your Honor, that stems from the fundamental right of marriage. And in this particular case, Mr. Delfell was found guilty, and due to the fact that he is married to the victim's mother, he faces enhanced penalties. And that does affect a person should not.
What to establish an equal protection violation, you have to establish that your client was treated differently than similarly situated individuals. And the first step of the analysis is to identify the similarly situated class. So what is that class? Who are the similarly situated individuals that we would compare to?
So the similarly situated persons would be those persons that are married versus those persons that aren't married that have committed the exact same act.
Well, no, those persons who are not married are not similarly situated to those persons who are married. Similarly situated means just that. How is your client being treated differently than any other person who does that, who's married?
My client is not being treated differently than anyone else that is married. The objection is to that the marriage itself creates that greater penalty. And so,
are you
when
saying
compared to
it's infringing on his right to marry?
It is definitely a consideration. Someone shouldn't have to condition their decision to be married based upon what enhanced penalties they may receive. For example, if we had a speeding ticket statute that says if you're married, your penalty is greater. Well, number one, that's not narrowly tailored to any legitimate state interest. And two, the fact that someone is just married creates that enhanced penalty.
And what is the marriage enhancement here? How does the marriage impact the charge or the sentence?
The marriage in this case falls under the category that there is a significant relationship that exposes the client or the appellant here to greater penalties than if there was no significant relationship.
So by being married to the victim's mom?
By being married to the victim's mother, correct.
All right, well, if you were going... Now it sounds like the kind of challenge you would be mounting would be a substantive due process challenge, that this law has no rational basis, therefore, you know, like the speeding ticket scenario. It doesn't make any sense. Isn't there a rational basis for saying that if someone has a significant relationship and therefore access to a sexual assault victim by reason of marriage to the victim's mother, I mean, that seems to be a rational connection, doesn't it?
I would agree, but I think strict scrutiny applies to this case because, again, it is just the fact that he's married that is exposing him to this greater penalty. But for the fact he was married...
Say strict scrutiny applies. What is the fundamental right that's at stake?
The right of marriage. Although he's free to marry whoever he desires to marry, the decision of marriage shouldn't be conditioned upon the possibility that you would be exposed to greater penalties by simply that marriage alone.
Well, I'm sorry.
That's a heck of an argument. So the argument is, boy, my decision whether to marry is impacted because if I want to sexually abuse my partner's daughter, I might be subject to a greater consequence if I marry the mom.
Well, I don't think specifically applied to that statute, but generally applied any time that the marriage is...
Is there any other criminal offense in which marriage is an enhancement or an element of the offense?
Your Honor, I'm not prepared to answer that question because I don't know if there is any other one, to be quite candid with the court.
Judge Flory, did you have a question?
Judge Larkin asked my exact question.
Well, you're running out of time, but let me ask you a question on these constitutional issues. How do we set aside State versus Schleicher in order to address any of the constitutional issues you're presenting us today?
In that this court has the inherent ability to address issues that are issues that the court feels in the interest of justice need to be corrected, that the court needs to intervene. It is an inherent authority within this court. And the mechanism that the appellant has chosen this case is to bring it to the court's attention that there should be a difference between some, and the penalty shouldn't be the same for, I think we could all agree that death is a more severe consequence than any crime that doesn't result in death. And so again, the comparison of the statutes which death is contemplated, resulting in a lesser penalty in which one where there is survival, that is a disproportionate consequence to the actual act itself or the crime itself.
Right. Again, take heed, if you will, of Judge Larkin's comments. She does sit on the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission and has done so for quite some time now. your time. You've got 6 seconds left, but you do have rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We'll hear from Respondent Counsel.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovic, and I'm an assistant Washington County attorney. I represent Respondent State of Minnesota. In this case, the appellant presents two arguments, neither of which were raised to the district court. The state's position is that this court should not and need not even reach the merits of those issues. But even if the court does so, the court, I believe, will conclude that they lack merit.
You also agree there's no interest of justice reason that we would approach these issues?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I laid out at least three of them in my brief, which were that, first of all, the statute that the appellant was sentenced for is not actually the sentence that, or the statute that he's challenging the constitutionality of, that there was no good reason not to raise the issue below, and also that the briefing in the state's position is inadequate for the court to strike down any statute, but much less a very important statute like this one.
Would you agree with Judge Larkin's statement that this is more of a policy matter for which the sentencing guidelines, Minnesota sentencing guidelines, should take the priority role?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think with regard to the crimsex statute, the legislature determined that what sexual penetration includes. But it obviously includes penetration by any number of possible body parts or other objects. The legislature decided that all of that was part of sexual penetration. And the sentencing guidelines then, as the court noted, determines the proper severity level and proper presumptive sentences for that based on the legislature's definitions and how it writes the statute. So I would absolutely agree. I would also note on a similar note that with regard to cases involving a death of a person, the legislature, again, is in the position to decide the severity of crimes in terms of maximum sentences. Something like manslaughter is probably not as severe in some ways as a criminal sexual conduct case in the sense that I think mens rea matters. And obviously in a manslaughter context, you have a lower mens rea, negligence, gross negligence, culpable negligence, whatever it might be. Here you have an intentional act of someone, and it's frankly something that it's not an accident, it's not a mistake, it's something that any reasonable adult knows is wrong and the appellant chose to engage in it anyway. And the legislature's in the best position to address that. One factual clarification I wanted to make from the appellant's argument in response to a question early on. As I read the complaint, both of the two counts in this case are from the same date, September 22nd, 2017, and I believe they are the same behavioral incident in the sense that...
Well, that creates an issue and a problem for this court. Nobody raised that, at least appellant counsel did not raise that in his briefing. In terms of the sentence that was imposed by Judge McBride in this case.
Right.
He's agreeing it's the same behavioral instance, and you're saying the sentencing is possibly incorrect because there are two separate behavioral incidents?
No, I believe there is only one behavioral incident. I think this is essentially two ways of committing the same crime because he was both in a position of authority and in a significant relationship with the victim. There isn't a sentencing issue here in terms of multiple sentences being imposed because there was only one sentence imposed. I just looked at yesterday the warrant of commitment to make sure, as well as the sentencing transcript, because I thought about this as well. And both of those documents make clear that Judge McBride only imposed a sentence on count one, which is the position of authority count. There was not a sentence imposed as to count two, the significant relationship count.
But there were judgments of conviction on both?
Yes.
Probably in violation of 60904.
I think the answer to that is probably yes. I just thought about that yesterday as I was rereading the file.
So wouldn't we have to vacate that?
I think that the court, if it feels it appropriate to do so, and the issue hasn't been raised, obviously, but I think it may be appropriate to vacate the conviction for count two, which is the significant relationship conviction, because of that, but not because the statute is unconstitutional. I think that's another reason not to even get to that issue, frankly.
Are the presumptive sentences for both counts the same?
Yes, okay. They are the same. The maximum sentence, the presumptive sentence is all the same.
And the constitutional challenge is only to the count on which sentence was imposed?
Well, the only as to the count to which sentence was not imposed.
Well, that's the problem.
Well, that's why I don't think it makes sense to review it.
It wasn't raised, so do we have to review it?
No, the court absolutely doesn't need to review the constitutionality of the statute because it wasn't raised below, and there's no reason to because...
Well, and then how would we know? We don't have the... I don't recall that there was the sentencing transcript. There may be... I can't recall if that was in the record or not.
It is. There is a sentencing transcript in the record.
But I recall now, but it doesn't indicate the order in which you're now prescribing.
I guess, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question, Your
Honor.
All right.
I have a problem with how this was sentenced. I'm not sure how we can step around it because a correction to a sentence is something that can happen any time.
But isn't the issue that, so the count that he's challenging, judgment of conviction was entered, but no sentence was imposed.
Correct.
He has judgment of conviction on different subparts of the same statute, which would violate 60904.
It might very well violate that statute. And if the court feels it's appropriate to vacate the conviction on count two...
Which wasn't sentenced.
Yes.
There goes his argument about constitutional issues, and he's in the same position.
Precisely, Your Honor. And I would just note that I think if the court does go that route, the proper remedy is obviously not to vacate the guilty plea, but just the conviction. So the guilty plea would remain.
And we don't have any issue. Sometimes when we say, okay, we've got two judgments of convictions, which one should go? We have to say, well, which is the more serious? There are different penalties. We don't have that issue here.
We do not have that issue here. They're precisely the same. They're literally two ways of committing the same crime, same maximum sentence, same severity
level. And
this
court sometimes does recognize situations in which more than one judgment of conviction was entered inappropriately, and we remand for the district court to correct it. So this would not be unusual for us to take this approach in a case where the state agrees there should not have been two judgments of conviction.
Correct, Your Honor. I would agree with that. And I think that makes the disposition of the constitutional issue very simple, that there's no reason to review it. It's yet another reason, I'd say, not to review it. Finally, just I'll briefly touch on the sentencing issue. I would just note that what the appellant would need to show that this was cruel in violation of the Minnesota or federal constitution is that the sentence is grossly disproportionate to the crime committed. And the state would submit that the appellant has not made any showing of disproportionality, much less gross disproportionality. That is the test. And in fact, the Supreme Court, albeit on different facts, and with the finding of a heinous element, as an affirmed a sentence of life without parole for a sexual assault. And I'm not trying to claim that this case is the same as that case, but my point is that a sentence of life without parole can be imposed in a sexual assault case, and it does not violate the Constitution. So a sentence of 25 and a half years for a repeat sex offender who committed another sexual offense on a small child is not grossly disproportionate. With that, unless the court has any further questions, I will simply ask the court to affirm the conviction, at least as to count one. If the court chooses to vacate the conviction as to count two, the state doesn't object to that. And then also to affirm the 306-month sentence because the vacation of the conviction on count two would have no effect on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court. The reason why that other count is significant is because that conviction does create a criminal history for future enhancements. Should he commit any other crime in the future, that conviction would therefore be used against him. And so
it wouldn't. It's my understanding that convictions are only counted in the criminal history score if sentence was imposed or stayed on the conviction.
Then I stand corrected by the court. That is the concern. If the state is conceding that both of those convictions would be a violation of 60904, then I guess I would agree with that to achieve the right result in this case. I'm asking the court in this case.
You would agree with simply
vacating
the conviction you're challenging because it violates 60904.
It does, and it remedies the problem. It does remedy the issue of the marriage itself by that remedy. Your Honor, the court, I want to consider the idea that all rapes are not the same. All, and there is a graduation of that penetration by brush or instrument or something that, as the court had indicated, there, I would say, even myself, if I were the subject of a victim of a sexual assault myself, I would want there to be some restraint to that person from just touching me to continuing the act forward, similar to the way the kidnapping statute recognizes that the safe escape, it is a recognition that there is a half penalty when you don't go through to the extent that the other part of the kidnapping statute where there is not safe release or there is harm, and that there should be some mechanism within the definition of penetration that recognizes that difference and recognizes that severity to the extent that it doesn't expose to the additional emotional effects that could be for some victims very much different. The difference between being touched and penetrated for some victims may make the complete difference. And although I don't have any...
Isn't that the problem for some victims? What about the some victims that is just the opposite of what you're saying? They're both horrible.
They are both horrible.
How do you decide some victims and some victims? I mean, isn't that the impasse you have on trying to parse it out?
Well, and that's why, you know, that's why, Your Honor, I sort of introduced the idea of human notice.
Legal concept?
It's not a legal concept. It's one that...
How do we even rely on that in an opinion that you've put forth to... I mean, I don't see where you've provided us, Mr. Wolfgang, with any authority to, other than your opinion.
Well,
and
your,
how do we change what happened here based on your opinion?
Your Honor, I'm asking the court to recognize that there is a difference in the graduation of the offense, that all of them are not the same. And so I don't come to this court with authority because, you know what, quite candidly, there isn't any favorable, there's not a lot of favorable authority on sex offenders in general. And specifically, there isn't anything on point. There isn't anything where this has come before the court specifically asking the court to determine that there should be some sort of graduation between the different types of penetration. So I don't have any authority there because it hasn't come before the court. I couldn't cite it. I wouldn't necessarily recognize it at the point. But after reflection, it is a lingering feeling that is just not the same.
Again, that's an argument that should be made to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, not this court.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. With that, I will close.
Thank you.
Thank you
to both counsel. And the matters are deemed submitted. A decision will be issued within the statutory time frame.
Now you're sitting on a pincushion. Oh, thanks a lot. I don't know if you can. Somebody's trying to fix it and get it all the way down. It's like an elevator.
Counsel, while you're settling in, I'll ask our marshal to call your case. Reminder, each of you has 15 minutes for presentation of your case. 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to exercise that privilege. When you're ready to proceed, please approach the podium. It does move up and down depending on your height preference, and indicate your name and which party you're speaking on behalf of before beginning your argument.